loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. We cover five stories today. First up, Hillary Clinton's new book on her election loss last year blames Bernie Sanders, the Russians, the media, James Comey, and others for her surprising defeat. Who did she leave out? Next, we talk about South Korea. Thousands of police and protesters are facing off in the village of Sangju, just hours ahead of the deployment of U.S. THAAD rocket launchers. Then we go to Puerto Rico and talk about Hurricane Irma, the largest storm in Puerto Rico's history. Also, New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez goes on trial today over 2 years after he was indicted on corruption charges. Who is Menendez, and could his trial impact the politics of the U.S. Senate? And finally, prosecutors continue to close in on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and now his wife Sarah Netanyahu is expected to be charged with fraud. But first, we turn to Hillary Clinton's new book on her election loss last year. She attacks Bernie Sanders. She attacks Russia. She attacks James Comey. She attacks everyone. Everyone's to blame except her. We are joined in studio by Kevin Zeese, the co-director of Popular Resistance. He's also a convener of the upcoming People's Congress of Resistance, which will take place at Howard University on September 16th and 17th. You can read his writings at popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, we're talking about Hillary Clinton, so let's start.
So what's the news? I don't understand. Hillary Clinton blames everyone but herself. Is there news here?
Yeah, well, you know, Hillary Clinton's mainly upset that there had to be an election.
Oh, yeah.
It should have just, I think she should have just been handed the presidency.
Been the queen.
Exactly. It should have been a coronation, not an election. How dare they? How dare they? Well, anyway, let's listen to Hillary Clinton talking at a code conference in May about what happened.
Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
You knew you were going to run for president, or you thought you might, or probably you were thinking about it. You had to be thinking about it as a possibility. Well, why did you do those? I don't.
Why do you have Goldman Sachs here? Because they pay us.
They paid me.
Yeah, no, but there's a...
Let's get serious.
I know they paid you, but
yes.
And they paid you a lot.
Yes,
but
yes.
You're not somebody who needed that money for the next week's shopping, and you knew you might have run, so why do it?
Well, I gave speeches to many, many groups. I spoke to camp counselors, I spoke to healthcare executives, I spoke to, you know, just a wide range of groups, right?
Kevin Zeese, it's really amazing. When you listen to it, she spoke to camp counselors and Goldman Sachs bankers who paid her $650,000, and she wouldn't say what it was that she said to them. I mean, complete denial.
She got 10 years of the average pay for one speech, the median pay for one speech. I mean, so, and she, why did they do it? Because they paid her. What else could they pay her to do? I mean, you know, looking at her record, and I know she says she is the same as Sanders in this article, this excerpt that came out. She says she agrees with Sanders and everything, but you know, not true. You look at the bailouts of Wall Street. You look at the single payer issue, where she is totally not in favor of improved Medicare for all, and Sanders is advocate for it. Issue after issue, she's on the side of the people with the money. Why? She explained it. They pay her. I mean, so this is she actually exposed the fundamental problem of her and her husband. These are neoliberal folks who believe in privatization of virtually everything. They don't see public service as the route to providing people with what they need. They see privatization. Why? Because they pay for it. I mean, it exposes her corruption unintentionally.
Yeah, And the Clintons, I think, got $141 million in speaking fees between 2000 when they left, or 2001 when they left the White House, and when she started to run for president in 2016. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. And you have to remember, this woman and her husband were basically the head of the Democratic Party, you know, with Barack Obama in between. What she's writing about in, Sanders was promising false promises that really couldn't be achieved. She's talking Democratic Party talking points there. And so, you know, this is the corporate wing of the Democrats that really control that party. And they've always controlled that party since it was the, you know, slavery-based party when it was first founded. It's been that way throughout its history. Even when FDR was their brightest spot, you know, he was doing it to save capitalism in that crisis moment. And so throughout their history, this is what the Democratic Party is in, and really the Clintons represent it.
The Bernie Sanders campaign represented the rebirth, in a way, of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party,
which
had been essentially crushed by the Clintons starting in the 1990s. Sanders' campaign was remarkable. Millions, tens of millions of people supported it, the idea of a political revolution, even if vaguely formulated. Clinton writes that Bernie Sanders is partly or largely to blame for her loss to Donald Trump. It's amazing. She said, Sanders had to resort to innuendo and impugning my character because they agreed on so much. I mean, they agreed on so much. As you said, student debt, no. Cancellation of student debt, no. Single payer, no.
College, no.
$15 an hour minimum wage,
no.
I mean, they didn't agree almost on anything. How did Bernie Sanders impugn her character?
I think he impugned her character by telling the truth and highlighting the fact that she was making these very expensive Wall Street speeches, that she had served on the Walmart board of directors. That she was getting incredible amounts of money from the healthcare profiteers. He impugned her character by pointing to her actions and really the actions of the Democratic Party. It's not Sanders was an unusual part of that. He is Democrat. I mean, as much as he claims he's independent, that's how you register in Vermont. You register as independent. But he has allied the Democrats his career. And so while he's an independent in name only, he really is a Democrat. But he does not represent the Democrats who are in charge of the party.
We're speaking with Kevin Zeese. You can read his writings at popularresistance.org. He's the co-director of popularresistance.org. Hillary Clinton is blaming Comey, blaming the Russians.
Blaming Sanders.
Blaming the expectation that she would win. That was another one she says in that interview. I was a victim because people thought I was going to win. And the interviewer says, but you thought you were going to win. She said, yeah, I was part of it. So there was a victim of too high expectations. Here's another one. Throughout the primaries, every time I wanted to hit back against Bernie's attacks, I was told to restrain myself, noting that his plans didn't add up and that they would inevitably mean raising taxes on middle-class families or that they were little more than a pipe dream. All of this could be used to reinforce his argument that I wasn't a true progressive. My team kept reminding me that we didn't want to alienate Bernie's supporters. President Obama urged me to grit my teeth and lay off Bernie as much as I could. I felt like I was in a straitjacket. So Obama, too, Kevin Zeese, is responsible for her defeat. It's everyone.
Everyone is to blame except her. And the reality is she has a long history that's very pro-war, that's pro-intervention, that's pro-corporate trade, that's opposed to a single-payer improved Medicare for all system. I mean, on issue after issue, she's wrong on the key issues. And what she always does, and what she always done through her whole career, is put the big corporations first, put the big money first. The people, you know, get rhetoric, but that's it. And so she, you know, she should really look in the mirror and blame herself. But it really doesn't matter any longer. Her career's over. She's not anything. And she's not running for anything in the future. She's, you know, she's finished as far as that goes. What really matters is where does U.S. politics go now? And I'm not sure the Democratic Party is capable of reforming itself from the Clinton-Obama era. They put in place Tom Perez as the DNC head. He is a creation of the Clinton and Obama tradition. That's all he's done, really, is work for Clinton and Obama. And so they have not reformed themselves. And so there's a crisis in the Democratic Party. And I don't think Bernie Sanders can save them. You know, I don't see him getting through the Kamala Harris is the more likely one. Or, you know, the former governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick. That's who the Clintons and the Obamas are supporting, those two. That's where it's going. And so the real question is, how do we save U.S. politics? If you have a Republican Party the way it is, the Democratic Party is a corporatized party that puts privatization first. How do we save U.S. politics so people get represented? That's the real challenge we face.
I couldn't agree with you more. Hillary Clinton is washed up. Okay. But as you're pointing out, her policies are actually the dominant policies in the Democratic Party. I mean, she lost the most unpopular candidate in U.S. history. That would be Donald Trump. She lost. She lost battleground states. She won the popular vote, but she lost battleground states, and she didn't even visit them. So in part, it's just negligence or hubris or arrogance. She didn't go to Wisconsin, for instance.
Amazing.
I mean, amazing. And she just took everything for granted, like she shouldn't have to go through an election. It should just be given to her.
And Trump was like a joke almost. Why take him seriously?
Yeah. But here we are. Let's talk about the big issue. The big issue seems to me, one of the big issues, in addition to the enduring issue of war and peace, is the question of single-payer health care. In other words, that's the crying need not addressed by the Democrats. Obama said it's off the table when he had control of both houses of Congress. What comes next? We have 1 minute left.
And even though Obama was a single-payer supporter before he got into power.
Then you become president, it's off the table.
What comes next is the people have to organize and mobilize. That is what's going to determine the outcome of that battle of Medicare for All. We have a project called the Hope Campaign, Health Over Poverty for Everyone, healthoverpoverty.org. Get involved. It's going to be the people who decide that future. The politicians will only go there if there's pressure from below, and that's our job. So as much as we can point to Clinton and Obama and blame them, the reality is we have not built the movement, and that's our responsibility. And so if we want to know how we're going to get Medicare for All, how we're going to end this war-based economy, it's going to be us getting organized and doing something. And that's why it's so important we're getting together for the People's Convention.
The People's Congress of Resistance. Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, Dr. Margaret Flowers, both co-directors of the PopularResistance.org, will be speakers on September 16th, 17th at the People's Congress of Resistance. You can go to the website congressofresistance.org to learn about it. Show up if you're in the Washington, D.C. area. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Thousands of police and protesters are facing off in the South Korean village of Songju just hours ahead of the deployment of four new U.S.-operated THAAD rocket launchers. We are joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun, a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korea Peace Network. And we are joined from Atlanta by Will Griffin. He is a member of the Task Force to Stop THAAD in Korea and Militarism in Asia and the Pacific, as well as a member of Veterans for Peace. And Simone, I think you too are a member of that task force. Anyway, Simone Chun and Will Griffin, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Before we begin, let's hear a short audio clip. It's the State Department spokesperson speaking to a press conference in July defending the deployment of THAAD and talking about a high-level U.S.-South Korean discussions on that issue.
We had a very productive meeting with Mr. Moon when he came over here. I believe it was last week. We have had, I know the secretary met with his counterpart, the foreign minister, here that same week, and they had lots of discussions about the importance of THAAD, the alliance decision that was made, and the reason that those decisions were made to deploy THAAD in the first place. And that is the safety and the defense of our partners over there, as well as the safety and defense of our U.S. forces over there.
Okay, Professor Simone Chun, safety and defense of Americans and our allies. That was back in July. Now, the South Korean government, Moon, and she was speaking about Mr. Moon, that's the new president, Moon Jae-in, they've decided to allow U.S. forces in Korea to deploy four new Terminal High Altitude Area Defense launchers tomorrow. That's THAAD. Talk about the situation, if you would.
Yes, this is a very tense and desperate situation, and more than 8,000 policemen are occupying the small village, and there are less than 500 villagers and the peace activists trying to hopelessly stop the additional deployment of four THAAD launchers. And we have to remember that there has been the movement against THAAD has been peaceful. It has gone on more than a year, and this is truly disgraceful that President Moon Jae-in is allowing this travesty. But most importantly, we have to remember that this is part of America's strategy. That is, instead of finding peaceful solution, they've been continuing escalation. So this has to stop. And at this moment, the only thing we can do is at least to show solidarity with those villagers who are desperately trying to stop it.
Okay, that's the voice of Professor Simone Chun. Professor Chun wrote in her newsletter today, quote, villagers need your help. They are outnumbered by overwhelming police force and army. Shame on all those who trample democracy. Will Griffin, you are there. You are in Sungju, in the village where Thaad is being deployed and where the people there clearly don't want Thaad. Talk about why they don't want it. Talk about how it's impacting the people in the area.
Well, previously, before the deployment of Thaad, there was no U.S. military presence there. Now that the Thaad system is there and they're trying to put more additional launchers there today, they are now a target, and they see themselves as a target now, and they don't want to be part of that. They don't want U.S. soldiers running around their towns. They don't want the radar surveilling over their entire village or town, and they don't want escalation, any type of militarized escalation against North Korea, against China. They want to engage in talks. They want to demilitarize, and they're just sick of just abiding by whatever the U.S. military tells them to do. They want to have a say in what goes on in their own towns.
Professor Chun, the people there have been holding protests in Sungju almost every day, perhaps every day, since it was announced that Thaad would be deployed. When the presidential election was taking place after the removal, the impeachment of the former conservative president Park Geun-hye, the U.S. government seemed to race to deploy Thaad before Moon Jae-in came in because he was said to be a progressive and a critic of the deployment. How do you think this will impact his politics? Obviously, there's a lot of tension between North Korea and the United States, North Korea and South Korea. That tension is being used as the pretext for the deployment of Thaad. But Will Griffin says Thaad doesn't really make the people safer, at least the people there, because they then become targets in a broader military sort of geostrategic showdown.
Yes, this is clearly a downward spiral heading to a disaster. I think President Moon Jae-in has made a major mistake. Remember, he had the overwhelming 80% of support from Korean people. He could have used his political capital to swiftly delay or postpone or stop the Thaad. He had the opportunity. He chose not to do so. President Moon Jae-in should be accountable and also responsible for the mistake that he has made.
Yes, we hear you there. Will Griffin, I mean, here we have a situation where North Korea has detonated a very major nuclear test, its sixth test. The U.S. has done more than 1,000 nuclear tests. Russia and previously the Soviet Union has done 700 tests. North Korea has done six tests. I mean, clearly North Korea believes that nuclear weapons are quintessential or existential for their own national security. Instead of the deployment of Thaad, instead of militarization, instead of threats, what would be the other way that the United States might go?
Well, I think the United States could just listen to what North Korea and China and Russia have been calling for years now, and that's a freeze for a freeze. North Korea is happy to freeze its nuclear weapons program as long as the U.S. stops threatening them with nuclear strikes, as well as stopping the annual war games that happen on the peninsula and in the region every single year, several times a year, that some would call the world's largest military training exercises in many different ways. So just listening to North Korea and seeing what they have to say instead of refusing to sit down at the table and talk with them, that's really the only option that we really have now to try to reach an agreement that doesn't involve war or more militarization of the Korean Peninsula.
I think we've lost Professor Chun on the phone, but Will Griffin, let me ask you, Nikki Haley yesterday at the United Nations, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations said North Korea is begging for war. I mean, that seems to be highly provocative. Is North Korea begging for a war? I mean, North Korea, South Korea, they had a war. It was a catastrophe. Talk about why the U.S. is deploying this kind of language.
I mean, I think if anyone who's been paying attention to foreign policy in the past 16 years knows that this type of talk is just a run-up to some type of intervention or regime change. We saw it in Libya and Iraq and all over the Middle East. It's very, very scary. The difference between the Middle East and the Asia Pacific is that we're now dealing with nuclear-armed states, and demonizing and trying to go to war with North Korea is not just going to be a Korean War. It's going to be a regional war. It's going to be we're going to have effects on the global economy. We're talking about millions and millions of people being killed in a short amount of time, within days, most likely. So this talk is very, very dangerous. And I think, you know, the American people need to kind of wake up and start paying attention to what's going on 10,000 miles away.
I hear you. We have about a minute left. Will Griffin, the people in Korea don't want a war. The people in Japan don't want a war. People in the United States don't want a war. Here you have a situation where the U.S. policymakers, some of them seem to be of the opinion that war is inevitable with North Korea, so it's better to have it now before North Korea gets even stronger technologically. I mean, is that part of what's going on? Is there a faction in Washington that actually is believing that war is inevitable?
I think there's a huge part of our government. Like you said, the people don't want war, but it's the people in government, it's the people in corporations, in the defense industry, in the Department of Defense. They all want war because they see that as one, it's a way to make more money. It's a way to get promoted, and they think that's the only way to solve a solution. And it's surprising with the amount of intelligence that they have that they are ignoring the fact that the history in the region with North Korea and the fact that North Korea itself has called publicly and on the international stage that it does not want war. And I don't see how people are not seeing what North Korea's behavior is like as a response to the U.S. militarism that's going on in the region. It's always a response to what the U.S. has been doing there. It has 83 bases there, 23,000 troops in South Korea. What if North Korea had one base in Mexico? The Pentagon would flip out.
We're going to leave it there. We were joined by Professor Simone Chun. We were talking to her from Seattle, and we've also been talking from Atlanta with Will Griffin. I believe, Will Griffin, that there is one section of the U.S. establishment that thinks war is inevitable. I think there are others who believe that that's complete madness. We'll see how that debate plays out. Anyway, we'll come back to this subject later. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. After the devastation of Hurricane Harvey, a new massive storm called Hurricane Irma is barreling through the Caribbean. We are joined from Aybonita, Puerto Rico, by Camilo Punzada. He's a spokesperson for Juventud Trabajadora, the youth wing of the Working People's Party of Puerto Rico. Welcome back, Camilo.
Thank you for inviting me over. I'm glad to be here with you.
Thank you for joining us. Of course, after all of the devastation in Houston, everywhere that people are watching, they're watching with great concern. You're in Puerto Rico. Tell me about what it's like right now.
Well, right now, Hurricane Irma hasn't reached its climax, and the winds are not as heavy as they're going to be in a couple hours. Right now, what I can see through the window is it's just a lot of heavy rain and heavy winds that are going to be getting worse and worse. But for now, that's what it looks like. I don't have any power at the house that I'm at, and a lot of sectors in Puerto Rico don't have any electric services either. So that's the view right now of what's happening.
Tell us about the preparations for Hurricane Irma, where you are. Ricardo Rosella, governor of Puerto Rico, said, "The dangerousness of this event is like nothing we have ever seen. A lot of infrastructure won't be able to withstand this kind of force." I mean, Puerto Rico is not unused to hurricanes. Cuba, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, of course, the southern states of the United States, you have big storms. It's hurricane season. But the governor is saying this is nothing like we've ever seen. What are you expecting? What are the people expecting? And we'll talk about the preparedness.
Yeah, we have never gotten hit by a Category 5 hurricane, which is the case of Irma. And with winds up to 185 miles per hour, the power system in Puerto Rico, the electric system, is very deteriorated, and power outages are very common. And with the hurricane coming, many sectors of the island are already without electric services, such as myself. Which brings me to another point. that I want to mention is then is the preparation that the governor didn't take. For example, right now we have the incinerator in Guayama, which is in the south. The incinerator has toxic ashes around it, and the wind and the rain are just going to spread those ashes, causing huge damage, environmental damage and health damage to the nearby areas. Also, we have communities like floodplain communities such as the Caño Martin Peña in Barrio Obrero, which are more susceptible to damages to their property and life-threatening situations. El Caño is historically a working-class community, and the bad planification from the government will make this community suffer the devastating consequences of the hurricane. So I guess we could say that the governor and the government didn't take the appropriate measures to make sure that people would be safe and that things like this, like the ashes being spread in communities like El Caño, were going to be safe and it wasn't nothing devastating would happen. So it had a lot to do with bad planification from the government, and we're going to see that in the next couple of days. It was estimated that the power service was going to be out. The Authority of Electric Energy said it was up to 4 months until the system was back to normal. So that's what we can expect right after Hurricane Irma, a couple of months without the electric service working, all these ashes, toxic ashes flying, or the water takes them to nearby areas. So, I mean, it's pretty catastrophic. People are shocked. They're worried. So we're expecting, we're in expectation right now towards what is going to conclude, how this is going to develop, really.
Puerto Rico has been declared bankrupt as a consequence of the financial crisis, again, not caused by the people of Puerto Rico. How big of a deal is that in terms of the impact on government, the ability of the government to deliver services here or outside of a natural disaster?
Okay, I mean, of course it affects us. We don't have any, since we have a $73 billion debt, to have the money for infrastructure purposes gets affected. That means that the development of the island after the hurricane is going to be slower. It's going to be harder. We depend on those that federal aid. So I think that this hurricane hit us in our worst time. I think that we got to be prepared for a lot of hard work and a lot of hard times, because we really just don't. We're not in our best situation, and this is just going to make it that much worse.
We're speaking with Camilo Punzada from Ay Bonita, Puerto Rico. He's about to be hit by the climax of Hurricane Irma, he and the other people on the island. Rick Scott, who is the Florida governor, urged residents to, quote, be aggressive to protect your family, and has declared an emergency across the state. He also said, quote, this is your responsibility. This storm has the possibility of devastating our state. Talk, Camilo, about the responsibility of state and federal authorities in a situation like this. And of course, Puerto Rico is not a state. Puerto Rico is a colony. Puerto Rico has been a colony ever since the United States invaded the island at the beginning of the so-called Spanish-American War more than 118 years ago. But talk about that question, the responsibility of the state and federal authorities. From your point of view, you are one of those you are the spokesperson for the youth wing of the Working People's Party of Puerto Rico. Go ahead.
Yes, first, before going into the responsibility of the state and federal with the consequences of the hurricane, I wanted to specify that Puerto Rico has been a colony even before the United States invaded Puerto Rico. It was a colony under Spanish ruling. But having that clear, first of all, up to a certain extent, we do have responsibilities with our house, with our family. But the government and the state does have a responsibility, and it is to guarantee shelters. It is their responsibility to foreshadow what could happen and try to prevent it. Just as the example that I mentioned with the ashes, the example that I mentioned with the community that is a floodplain area. So the government does have responsibility with Puerto Rico, with the country that is going to be affected, whatever government we're talking about, in this case, Puerto Rico. So it does have a responsibility. It is not just our responsibility, the people's responsibility. The government does need to take some action. And the federal government, now that you mention it, after the hurricane, there are supposed to be coming some federal aids for infrastructure purposes in Puerto Rico. Because, I mean, we've never been hit by a Category 5 hurricane, but the results can be devastating.
Camilo, let me ask you, as you've grown up in Puerto Rico, as you've seen hurricanes come and go, tropical storms come and go, are they getting more severe? Are the people in Puerto Rico aware that climate change, that global warming is impacting on the severity of hurricanes? Are you noticing that?
I think that I know, for example, that the global warming and the deterioration of the environment does cause this kind of severe atmospheric change and climate change that develops hurricanes. But I think that people still don't quite get the magnitude of what's going on and what causes it. Because, you know, hurricane is a natural phenomenon, but it does get worse with us contaminating the planet. The whole thing with the global warming does affect the severity of the hurricanes and tropical storms. But in my opinion, I think that people still haven't realized or still haven't connected the dots.
Let me ask you, we're almost out of time, Camilo. Talk about what's going to happen with you and your family. What are you expecting? Just paint a picture of what it's like right now and what you anticipate in the coming hours. And also, who are you with? Are you with your entire family?
No, my family is in San Juan. I'm with my girlfriend and her family over in the center of the island. We can expect loss of private property. We can expect flooded areas, damaged cars, for example, out of power for I don't know how long, the estimated 4 months. So this is all still pretty premature. I still don't know what to expect. Like I said, Puerto Rico has never faced anything like a Category 5 hurricane. So,
keeping your fingers crossed.
Yes, exactly. We're still speculating up to this point towards what's going to happen. I do know that with the depth that we have, it's going to be pretty hard to try and get back on our feet. But it is possible. We just gotta keep calm and see.
Okay, I want to wish you, Camilo, all the best, and your girlfriend and her family, and of course your family in San Juan. We've been speaking to Camilo Punzada. He is a spokesperson for the youth wing of the Working People's Party of Puerto Rico. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez goes on trial today, over 2 years after he was indicted on corruption charges. Who is Menendez, and could his trial swing the balance of power in Washington? We are joined again from New York City by Ted Rawl, award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Welcome back, Ted.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to talk about Bob Menendez and his trial, but to give our audience a sense of his foreign policy orientation, I want to play a part of a speech he gave last year in criticizing Barack Obama's historic visit to Cuba, where Obama said the old policy of trying to isolate Cuba had failed. Obama went forward to normalize, not really, but starting to normalize in some ways, relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Let's listen to Menendez.
Instead of having the free world's leader honor Latin America's only dictatorship with a visit, he could have visited one of 150 countries which he has not visited, including several in Latin America that are democracies. The president has negotiated a deal with the Castros, and I understand his desire to make this his legacy issue.
Okay. I mean, Menendez, it's kind of odd. I mean, here he is under indictment, could go to jail, attacking Barack Obama because he wants to have normal relations with Cuba. Talk about Menendez's foreign policy orientation, his orientation to Cuba. But let's start first, Ted Rawl, with the trial. What is he accused of?
Well, it's basically a pay-for-play kind of deal that we've seen before in corruption scandals, for example, with Governor Ryan in Illinois and many other figures around the country, sometimes prosecuted successfully, sometimes not. But basically what you had was a wealthy constituent slash friend named a doctor named Solomon Melgen, a guy from Southern Florida, who spirited Senator Menendez around on his on various luxury planes, taking him to vacation, donating money to his campaign, and so on. And then what's alleged by the feds is that Senator Menendez was simply accepting these as bribes in order to help resolve the senator's the doctor's many issues. For example, getting visas for his girlfriends, trying to resolve a mess that the doctor got involved in with Medicare, as well as some business deals that were kind of shady in the Dominican Republic and elsewhere. So it seems that this was one of those things where the doctor threw some money at the senator. The senator returned his calls and then some, and palled around with him. Now the question is this illegal? Did it cross the line from unseemly into bribery and corruption and jailable or not? And that's what is at issue right now.
Yeah, and that other person, he's a Florida ophthalmologist, Solomon Melgen. He was convicted earlier this year in a separate case of defrauding Medicare for, I don't know, more than $90 million through illegal overbilling. That's Menendez's friend, the one who's buying him all the airplane tickets and all the other stuff. His sentencing has been put off until after Menendez's trial, and prosecutors say Melgen, as you said, flew the senator all over the place and showered him with gifts. Melgen is going to be coming out to save his own skin now against Menendez. Do you think that's what's happening?
Well, I mean, that's the speculation. It's not a sure thing. I mean, the delays in the court system could mean something, and could be an innocent and might not have anything to do with a quid pro quo or a plea bargain between the doctor and the government. But there's just no telling. This is, it's none of it looks good. And certainly the feds are desperate to get Menendez. They have had some failed prosecutions of similar cases in the past. There was a case recently of a former New York City councilman I think he was a state senator, actually, a big power broker in Albany, who recently flew the coop after spending a few years in prison. So these slippery politician cases are not that easy to prosecute, and I think they would like to get this scalp on their wall if they can.
So I want to go kind of quickly now, Ted Rall, because I want to talk about what's going to happen with Menendez's case. I mean, it seems on its face obvious corruption, but that's just to like somebody who's looking at everything rationally, if the facts are true. But even if the facts are not disputed, is it likely that Menendez might get off because his lawyers are trying to use a Supreme Court decision from last year that narrows the scope of what constitutes corruption? That case involved Virginia Governor Bob McDonald. I mean, it's quite amazing. McDonald was being showered with gifts, and in exchange, he got a $50,000 loan from a nutraceutical entrepreneur named Johnny Williams. And minutes later, he texted an aide to make sure that Williams got meetings he wanted with a Virginia state official. The jury said McDonald was guilty of corruption, but then the Supreme Court intervened on McDonald's behalf and said, well, that's not necessarily corruption. Maybe in America, the definition or criteria of corruption has become such a low bar that no one's corrupt. This is business. This is the way America runs.
Yeah, well, and that's been the defense that's been used with some degree of success by a number of politicians who faced similar charges. So is it corruption? Merriam-Webster would say it's corruption, no question about it, if these facts are true. Rich guy throws money at senator who shouldn't be accepting a single dime from anyone, and then is able to get all sorts of favors. On the other hand, It is also true that this is the way business is done in Washington and state capitals and cities around the nation, right? So if you start, if you say that all of this is all corruption, well, I mean, you probably have a hard time finding a public official who couldn't be indicted and successfully prosecuted. So I could see why the Supreme Court wanted to narrow the scope of what is prosecutable in a case like this. But it is also, you know, there is a widening gap between what an ordinary citizen would view as corrupt and what the law is officially going to send someone to prison over.
Let's talk about the politics of this. If Menendez is convicted, there would be pressure to oust him from his Senate seat. Given that Chris Christie, a Republican, is the governor of New Jersey, this means his replacement would likely be a Republican. Menendez is, in spite of his right-wing policies, which sound maybe to some people on their faces like right-wing Republican policies, he's a Democrat. What would this mean for Congress and for Trump's ability or the Republicans' ability to get laws passed if, in other words, they can replace Menendez, if convicted and then ousted, with a Republican because the Republican governor appoints him?
Yeah, it's one of the oddities of our constitutional system is that a state officer, namely the governor, can appoint a replacement senator. It's very quaint and doesn't seem to make a lot of sense in 2017, but it's still how the system works. So the practical effect of this would be that, particularly on domestic policy, you would see the Republicans and the Trump administration have an even just one more step, one little more lock on the Senate than they do now. They already control the Senate. They already have complete control of the. They already have dominant control of the Senate as well as the House, obviously. So it wouldn't flip the control of anything, but it would definitely just be it's sort of a safety zone for Trump and for the Republicans. Although they have enough other problems of their own that might not be enough to save Trump, but that might be another conversation for another time.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left, Henral. If Bob Menendez is convicted of corruption, he doesn't have to resign. He could still retain his Senate seat unless the Senate expels him, unless the Congress expels him. Would that be easier given the fact that the Congress is Republican-led and Menendez is a Democrat? Do you expect that kind of drama to unfold?
Well, you know, 10 years ago, I would have said absolutely not. But we're increasingly seeing scenarios where staying the course and keeping in office after you're shamed legally or politically seems to pay off more than putting your tail between your legs and running off. I mean, look at Bill Clinton. He's an elder statesman of American politics today. He was impeached in 1998. He left office merely 2.5 years later at the top of his game with high approval ratings. There's all sorts of cases like that where you look back at, for example, former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, who was convicted of a relatively minor crime of money laundering, I think $5,000 or $6,000 to pay a prostitute. And we look back now, and I think most New Yorkers would take Mr. Spitzer back as governor tomorrow if they could. So if I were advising Senator Menendez right now, I would tell him, stay cool, hold the course. We live in shameless times. Just look at our president. Just hang tight. A hurricane will come in, blow you off the headlines. Don't worry about it. Americans have short memories.
You sound cynical, Ted.
Joyful, but cynical, yes.
Joyful, but cynical. Okay, that's all the time we have. We've been joined from New York City by Ted Rawl, award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Prosecutors continue to close in on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and now his wife, Sarah Netanyahu, is expected to be charged with fraud. We're joined from Greece by Dan Cohen. He is a journalist and filmmaker. Welcome back, Dan.
Good to be with you, Brian.
Thank you for joining us. Before we begin, I want to play a short audio clip. It's from an anti-Netanyahu protester at a rally last month explaining the controversy to the media outlet Ruply. Let's listen to this protester, and then I want to get your comments.
The main thing is that a German company sold submarines to Israel, and there is a lot of corruption, a lot of bribery here in this. We are talking about huge amount of money. And I will suggest that also the Germans will stop everything and will investigate and see what is the source, how much bribery was paid to the two people, to the lawyer of our prime minister and other people.
Dan Cohen, tell us what it's all about.
Right. This protester is absolutely right. This should be investigated. This is billions of dollars worth of money that Netanyahu has basically negotiated with a German submarine company. It's a huge scandal in Israel in which Netanyahu basically gave a sweetheart deal to, or it appears at least, he gave a sweetheart deal to a German submarine company, ThyssenKrupp, for a total of nine nuclear weapons capable submarines. To give a little bit of comparison, Britain and France have four each nuclear capable submarines. So it's unclear why Israel would even need that many. But basically, these submarines are, of course, extremely expensive themselves. And that's an enormous amount of money. But on top of that, it's the maintenance of basically a piece of metal in salt water is going to need enormous amounts of maintenance along with the electronics. And so this German company would build basically a place to repair these submarines over the next, you know, years and years. And it would amount to billions and billions of dollars. So that's kind of the biggest scandal that Netanyahu is facing right now. And that's not even the only one, actually, but that's probably the most consequential.
Benjamin Netanyahu was addressing Likud supporters last month, and he made the investigation out to be very, very unimportant, saying sarcastically, quote, "They're dealing with the most important things in the world, the procedure for replacing a light bulb, trays of food, the cup of tea that was served to her father, a righteous man, on his deathbed." Could this investigation, though, in spite of the fact that Netanyahu is minimizing, could it actually bring down the government?
It's definitely possible that Netanyahu could go down with this. What he's referring to with those comments were Sarah Netanyahu's lavish lifestyle in Prime Minister's official residence, where she ordered about $110,000 worth of fancy meals, which is illegal. She's not allowed to do, and charge them to the state. So, you know, Netanyahu is, of course, trying to minimize it, but you know, he's just talking about one of the scandals, and there are numerous ones. It could take the government down. It would be really interesting to see who would be replaced. Who would replace Netanyahu? Most likely is Gideon Sa'ar, a former minister who left politics briefly, but is basically staging his comeback. It wouldn't really radically shift politics in Israel. What is interesting is how it would affect the U.S.-Israel relationship, because Netanyahu is able to market himself, sell himself to Israelis in elections as the person basically most qualified to manipulate the U.S.-Israel relationship to Israel's benefit, which has a lot to do with, you know, his upbringing in his formative years in Philadelphia, his connections to neoconservatives. And so there's not really another Israeli politician who is so qualified to do that as he is. So it's unclear what would happen politically.
Yeah, and of course, Netanyahu has a real ongoing sort of, I don't know, honeymoon with the Republican Party that seems to never end. Not that he doesn't with the Democrats as well, but of course, we remember that famous speech before both houses of Congress where Netanyahu was invited by the Republicans and came and trashed the foreign policy initiatives of the sitting U.S. president, the U.S. head of state, before both houses of Congress because he was trying to condemn, sabotage the Iran deal. That showed that he did have a lot of standing in the United States. I mean, he could go against and even prevail against Obama in terms of the optics of that. Ultimately, of course, Obama went forward with the Iran nuclear deal in spite of Netanyahu and the Republican opposition. Today, it seems that Donald Trump and maybe some of his close advisors, who are not necessarily Republicans, but very tied to the military-industrial complex, they're not only friends with Netanyahu, they're trying to embrace that same program. I mean, outside of the personalities here, Does any of this impact on U.S.-Israeli relations during the era of Trump?
Ultimately, I don't think it will. The U.S.-Israel relationship is deep and storied, and you know, ultimately, I can't imagine this would be more than a blip. There's, you know, major weapons contracts and this sort of thing that you know, run far deeper than, you know, a class of personalities or a political struggle or anything like that. And as, you know, basically the generals in the have kind of, there's been, you know, the national security state coup in Trump's administration where, you know, McMaster and Mattis and these guys are now kind of firmly in control of the Trump administration. It's really hard to see the status quo being shaken up. And even, you know, Tillerson may be on his way out. And if you know, Nikki Haley replaces him, as it's rumored to do, and she's kind of the neoconservative darling right now, then I think that just reinforces the status quo of U.S.-Israel relationship.
Yeah, that's extremely important. The U.S., since Trump took office on January 20th, the policy has gone further and further and further to the right, especially on U.S. foreign policy. It may not have been that much different if Hillary Clinton had been elected, but the trajectory seems to be very discernible to the right, very hawkish, with the difference being that you have an unpredictable president who, well, nobody knows exactly what Donald Trump might do. He's so much bluster and bluff, but who knows? I mean, the world is also a bit anxious about that. Dan Cohen, I want to ask you about something that Netanyahu said today. We have about 3 minutes left. He spoke about the improving relations between Israel and Arab states, saying, quote, "What is actually happening with the Arab states has not happened in our history, even when we signed the agreements. There is cooperation in various ways on various levels, but it is not yet out in the open. But what is not yet out in the open is the much greater than in any other period in Israeli history. This is a major change. The entire world is changing." Netanyahu sounds to be sort of happy about the status of things in the Middle East and where Israel stands with Arab nations. Talk about that, if you would. That might be confusing for our general audience that's not paying careful attention.
Right. Well, Netanyahu is referring to what the education minister, Naftali Bennett, called right-wing peace, which is Israel establishing, you know, so-called peace deals with Arab monarchies, particularly the Gulf countries, without having any kind of negotiated settlement with Palestinians. So Palestinians are kind of just left out. And in particular, it's with Saudi Arabia. Last month, Netanyahu said he looked forward to the day when the prime minister of Israel can go to Saudi Arabia. And they're basically united in their hatred for Iran. Of course, Israel is you know, very hawkish on Iran and wants basically regime change there. As Saudi Arabia does too, sees it as a regional foe. So basically the concept is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so this is kind of the awful alliance that we see emerging from Israel and the Gulf monarchies.
In the last minute, Dan Cohen, U.S.-Israeli relations, obviously Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, economic aid. It was increased greatly by President Obama, a 10-year deal, which Netanyahu sort of publicly complained about because it wasn't enough. I mean, why does, in your point of view, and we have less than a minute, so you can't adequately cover it, why does the U.S. kind of give a blank check to the Israeli politicians sort of no matter what?
Well, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with not only, you know, Jewish Zionist influence in the U.S., but also Christian Zionists who outnumber Jewish Zionists by 10-1. So there's a major basically has to do with Christian Zionists see Israel as controlling this land as part of an apocalyptic fantasy, and so that's one of the major reasons. And then, you know, this is deeply embedded in the neoconservative movement, which is very, you know, pro-Israel and this kind of thing, and they see him as basically stalwart as the tip of the spear against Arab nationalism.
Yeah, we're unfortunately completely out of time. And it's so interesting too, Dan, just my final words, that this happens while a greater and greater part of the Jewish American community is turning out to publicly disagree with the policies of the Israeli government. That was Dan Cohen. He's a journalist, filmmaker. We talked to him from Greece. We're out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day at 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.